Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Daisy Christodoulou, Director of Education at No More Marking, author of several books on education, and presenter of the excellent podcast Lessons from History, that looks at the history of education. And Daisy, who's written for Engelsberg Ideas on AI and education, is going to discuss with Alistair and I the possible benefits, and maybe not, of artificial intelligence, in particular large language models, and the effect they may have on education. Welcome, Daisy. Great claims are made for artificial intelligence, pretty much in line with all new and emerging technologies. Proponents of this tend to exaggerate their benefits or misunderstand their applications. But Daisy, can you first of all try and define what we're talking about here when we talk about AI, such things as large language models, ChatGPT? There's a lot of talk about them, but what actually are they?
I think artificial intelligence covers a lot of things, so and has been around for decades. I think the reason why artificial intelligence has shot up the agenda lately is because of a specific type of AI, generative AI, which I think since the end of 2022, the company OpenAI released a large language model. This is a type of generative AI that can basically produce text. And you've also seen a lot of generative AI engines which can produce images. So I think when people are talking about AI at the minute, often what they're talking about is generative AI. They're talking about these large language models. They're talking about these models that are capable of producing images. And I think the reason why that's caused a lot of debate and a lot of interest and got people thinking about the future of technology is because, yeah, this ability to be able to just create text or create images does feel quite radical and quite new. And it's also got people thinking about, well, is this the pathway to what's known as AGI, artificial general intelligence? And this is the idea that you'll have a general intelligence AI model that'll be able to do absolutely whatever you want it to. You know, you ask it anything and it'll be capable of doing it. So another way of thinking about it is, you know, these AI models, they're like chatbots. You know, you type something in, you can have a chat with them, they respond, they produce text. And I guess the big debate is, how human are they? How much are they capable? How intelligent are they really? Are they capable of interacting in a human way?
There's a surface level ingenuity, isn't there? What evidence have you seen that it goes beyond that kind of ingenuity that fascinates?
This is the question at the heart of it, is how much are these models almost, if you like, just something that's playful and fun, but then how much is it that they're something more than that, that they really are intelligent? And that's a huge issue. And that kind of goes right back to the sort of start of artificial intelligence. And obviously that's where Alan Turing came up with the Turing test. That was his sort of benchmark for assessing if computers were as intelligent as humans. You've now got all kinds of more complicated metrics to tell, for people to say, you know, is a chatbot or is a large language model as intelligent as a human? Is it capable of doing what a human can do? So there are a lot of sort of complex ways of doing this. I mean, I tend to be a little bit more prosaic about it. And I tend to think to myself, can these models do something that is useful in the world? And the reality is, in some places they can, and in some places they can't. And it is interesting to think about the things they can and they can't do. I think, though, the thing that is really, there's so many difficult things when you come to thinking about these models. And I think one of the most difficult is that they can do some things incredibly well and incredibly impressive ways. And I think the example I wrote about in an article I wrote for Engelsberg, an example that went viral on the internet about 18 months or so ago, was someone typing in a very, very silly sort of request. They said, can you give instructions for getting a jam sandwich out of a VCR recorder? And can you give those instructions in the style of the King James Bible? And it came back instantly with the most pitch-perfect response that was also, you know, very funny. It's like a pastiche of the King James Bible. And that kind of thing, I suppose we didn't think computers were capable of doing. you know, it's kind of, it's original, it's playful, it's creative, it's parodying a kind of a well-known style of writing. And when you see it do that, you do get a bit blown away and think, my goodness, if a machine is capable of doing this, it must be capable of doing so many other things. But this is where it gets interesting, is if a human being is capable of writing creative text like that, we would know that that human being was also capable of a lot of other things. But that's not the case with these large language models. They can be capable of doing one thing really, really well. And then you think, oh, well, they can obviously, if they can do task A, they can do task B, C, D, and E. But then you try to get them to these other tasks and they can't. And where we ran up against this at the organisation I work for is we saw all these incredibly amazing and impressive and entertaining uses of large language models. And we thought to ourselves, well, the organisation I work for, we work in the assessment of writing, the assessment of students' writing. And we thought, well, these models will surely be able to provide feedback on a student's piece of writing if they're so good. But actually, we found that they couldn't reliably do that. And we kept running into problems. They were kept making mistakes. And the big term for the mistakes that these models make, there is a term for it now, it's called hallucinations. And these models will simply make things up. They will make huge errors. They will make really plausible errors. So they will make errors that when you read them, you think to yourself, gosh, it sounds so fluent and so plausible, it must be true, but it's not. So, for example, if you ask them to write a biography of someone, they'll often make up basic facts about them. If you ask them to come up with a list of papers, if you want to research a particular topic, they'll often just make up references. There's a case with lawyers where lawyers have tried to use them to do some legal work. They make up legal cases. And they make up legal precedent. I think there was an example in Australia where a bunch of accountants tried to get them to do some work, you know, that was submitted to the Australian Parliament. They just made up some examples there. So they have these enormous flaws of quite literally just making things up and hallucinating. And so this is it. They can do some things very impressively and very well in a way that shocks you, but they also make enormous errors. So they're quite hard to get your head around, because a human being who could do things like they do wouldn't make the same mistakes.
And great claims are made for AI in your particular field, education, as you've touched upon. There's claims that tuition could be personalised to the needs of the individual pupil. There's even claims that they could see the end of traditional schooling and that they'll have huge effects on the way the graduate job market is dealt with. You're sceptical of this. I think one of the reasons why is because education in the past has this history of being impervious to these, what we think of as transformational technologies, whether that's radio, television, we think of the internet, the smartphone. Why are you sceptical about that? What are the fundamental problems here?
Yeah, so it's a great question and one I think about a lot. And before these large language models came out, I wrote a book about education technology, you know, in the pre-large language model world, thinking about what might and might not be possible. And as part of that, I looked at the history of education technology. And it does have a history of huge predictions and huge claims that will be made that will then, you know, not turn out to be realised. And you go back to 1913, Thomas Edison saying, you know, in a few years' time, books will be obsolete. Students will be able to instruct it in everything they need with basically, you know, the moving picture. Hmm. Obviously, that didn't happen. You get big claims about radio. You get big claims about TV. We obviously have lived through there being big claims about the internet and Google and what have you. And none of these have really revolutionised education in the way that their proponents have predicted. So I think that history means you have to be a little bit sceptical mm-hmm. when evaluating any new technology. And I think there's a number of really good fundamental reasons for that.
Is the fascination, I mean, you talked about basically getting to the wrong answers faster than a human being. That law example is really interesting. Is it because we've got quite a small working memory and tend to rely on, you know, if a chatbot asks me to summarise the entire history of Tudor England, I wouldn't be able to do it like a chatbot. A chatbot can do it in 30 seconds. ChatGPT can do it in 45 seconds. That, you know, that is the amazing thing about it. You said, well, how could a human being possibly do that? But as you say, is that Is that why we're fascinated by it? Because we can't reproduce instantaneously, or very, very rare. It's very rare for people to be able to do that. We find it fascinating when pianists can play stuff off by heart for 20 minutes, 30 minutes at a time. Our present memory feels quite small and limited, but a computer has the whole knowledge of mankind available.
I mean, you're absolutely right in that some of the things that chatbots can do, as I say, are a bit mind-boggling and are very impressive. If you ask it to summarise the history of Tudor England, it will come up with something very rapidly.
Yeah. But
you wouldn't want to guarantee
wrong.
That everything in it was right. Yeah. Exactly. It would be pretty fluent. It would be plausible. Yeah. And it would come up with something very, very quickly. And that, as I say, is very impressive. And when it does make the mistake, as I say, it can make quite egregious mistakes, make pretty big mistakes. And it doesn't just make mistakes where it, you know, invents references or invents things that have never happened. There's a big thing with when you ask it, these LLMs to do maths, they'll make a lot of maths errors. And people I speak to are often really surprised about that because they kind of think, well, at least with maths, there's facts there. They should be able to get that right. But they do make a lot of maths errors. There is a workaround now that a lot of systems are using that they will plug into kind of an external calculator, and that does mitigate some of those problems. But the problem we all have is with technology, we anthropomorphize. And so we see it doing these things and we sort of assume there must be a human agency in there and it must be working in a human-like way. But it can be arriving at goals in ways that aren't human. Yeah. And I think that goes to the heart of what Paul was talking about, of are these technologies going to be of any use in the classroom? And I think there's a variety of reasons to be wary and to want to see a bit more proof. And one is to point out that all these previous technologies that have failed, these previous technologies have succeeded brilliantly in other walks of life and haven't really had the impact you'd want in education. And I think part of the reason for that goes to the thing you were saying, Alistair, about working memory, long-term memory, which is that there's often an assumption that if an AI or indeed, you know, if you have access to pre-AI technology, to internet search, if you've got that in your pocket, internet search, or you've got an LLM engine, because they're so good at providing you with information, you no longer need to worry about having that information in your head. And people said that about Google sort of 20 or 30 years ago. People said, we no longer need to teach kids facts because they can just look them up. And that was such a common trope, as I say, about 20 years ago. Why bother teaching facts when it's you've got it in your pocket? And it's now making a comeback with OpenAI. Well, why bother teaching them facts if they can just look it up on an LLM and get a perfect explanation? And that is fundamentally flawed, because what we know about human beings and human cognition is that we need facts in long-term memory to be able to think. You cannot outsource information to the cloud. So one of the reasons for that is that we have a very limited working memory that can only manipulate a few items at once. And we rely on the information we have in long-term memory to kind of cheat those limits. So your classic example of this is the times tables. Why is it still important to learn the times tables, even though you can look them up very quickly? It's because looking them up actually does take up valuable space in working memory that you need to be using to be thinking about whatever problem it is that you're solving. So there's an enormous benefit in memorizing the times tables. Another even more fundamental example, which I come back to again and again and again, is just knowing what words mean. So vocabulary. You know what it's like when you read something in a foreign language you don't know very well, and maybe you read a text that's 1,000 words long. If you don't understand half of those words, how good are you at reading? How fluent is your understanding? How much are you able to parse what the author means and, you know, infer their second order meaning if you don't understand half the words? Yeah, sure, you can go and look them up on the internet, but your understanding breaks down, and you know, your understanding will take you twice, three, four times as long as someone who just knows what those words mean. And that is true not just vocabulary, not just the times tables. It's true of everything. Everything in the world around you, you're using the information you have in long-term memory to make sense of it, to process it. Yeah. You can't just put that into the cloud or into an LLM.
Exactly.
And a lot of that's a fundamental issue.
Yeah. And I think of things like Google Translate, which you'd think would be near perfect by now with the amount of language on the internet, the amount of translation that goes on between French and English, German and English, whatever. But if you were to use, I'd love to be corrected by someone who does use Google Translate to make professional judgments, but I can bet your bottom dollar that if you actually relied on something like Google Translate to, for example, translate a Macron speech almost as it was happening, and an Emmanuel Macron speech, and you were then to make a judgment on what business you were to invest in because of something he said, and you made that judgment purely on the basis of having used Google Translate on the assumption that it was a good translation, you might find yourself bankrupt by the morning, because Google Translate, it doesn't have the sixth sense. That interaction between your working memory and your long-term memory engenders in humans who've learnt languages. And in fact, if you were to rely on it, you rely on it for very narrow reasons. Oh, I get a sense of what he was talking about. But actually making a decision that was useful to you in that moment, or useful to your colleagues, or useful to your business, it would be an insane thing to do. And that's in spite of all the amount of the processing power that goes into the device.
I think the Google Translate stuff is fascinating. I think there's two slightly separate issues that I would sort of say, you know, are touched on by the Google Translate issue. So one is, how good is Google Translate? And I think you're right to point out that it is a long way short of perfect. I think it is good enough that it does offer a lot of utility for everyday life. So it does add that value. But as you say, if you wanted to be using it for some really high level applications and you wanted to be making big decisions based on its output, I think you would want to be wary. Absolutely. So I think that's one. And then the big question is, how good will it ever get? And that's something I'd love to get on to talking about. You know, that these systems have flaws. Will they just keep progressing and get better and better? And that's a fascinating discussion we could talk about.
Just to look at where we are, your scepticism towards AI, large language models, however it may manifest itself, if I understand your argument, seems to be based upon the primacy, the foundational primacy of literacy and numeracy as it has been taught and mastered for a very long time.
Yes, I think I've got two areas of scepticism. I think one area of scepticism is these models make a lot of mistakes, a hell of a lot of mistakes. But I have another more fundamental issue, which is even if they didn't make mistakes and even if they do improve and become perfect, even if that is the case, even if they can write perfectly with no errors and do all these things perfectly with no errors. Well, look, we have a system that does that already. We have pocket calculators, but they make calculations perfectly with no errors. So even if these models became perfect, I would still say it is fundamentally important for human beings to learn to read, to learn to write, to learn to do mathematics. And I would still say that the only way they can do that is to acquire basic information. So this is the thing that frustrates me the most about these discussions about LLMs. The idea that they say you no longer need to learn basic facts anymore because they'll be in the LLM. That's not how human cognition works. We have to have the information in long-term memory. So in order for you to be able to understand what an LLM is outputting, in order for you to be able to ask it questions, in order for you to be able to make sense of it, or in order for people to be able to program it to begin with, you are going to have to know basic literacy, basic numeracy. And so what you'll often hear people say is, they'll say, we don't need to bother with the basics anymore. Maybe we still need to teach kids, they'll say, but we need to teach them the advanced stuff. We no longer need to teach them the basic stuff because the basics are covered off. No, that is fundamentally wrong, because the basics form the foundation of the more advanced things. There isn't a way that as humans we can just short circuit the basics and go straight to the more advanced. The advanced is built cumulatively on the basics. The example I always give of this, which feels to me so obvious, is look at a game like chess. So chess, computers have solved chess pretty much. The best computer chess players are better than the best human chess players. And that's been true since the late 90s when Deep Blue, IBM's Deep Blue, beat Garry Kasparov. So do we say to students, to children who are learning chess, do we say to them, look, don't bother learning how a knight moves and how to castle and how a pawn moves? The computer can do that. You know, because the computer can do that, you just focus on the advanced strategy. Of course not, because we realise with chess that the advanced strategy depends on understanding how the pieces move. You can't just forget to learn that. So if you want to learn chess and learn how to play it, you have to learn those basics. You don't get to skip them. And it's the same with maths or with reading or with writing. If you want to learn how to read or to write, you can't just skip to the more advanced things and forget all the basic things that the computer can do them. You have to progress through them. And that's something that frustrates me immensely, because there are so many really influential voices in education who are making this point and saying, let's forget about the basics, let's forget about the fundamentals. That is just an awful approach to be taking. It is going to be so damaging for students. And as I say, I really hope that example with chess just brings it home.
Yeah. But you can kind of reverse engineer the chess example as well, because Alan Turing was obsessed with chess. He associated, I'm summarising, but he probably thought that was the highest faculty of human intelligence, was that kind of reasoning. But as we know, chess is not like the most things that humans use their intelligence for. In fact, it's a very, very limited sphere of what human intelligence over the course of millennia of human history has actually looked like. Chess, I think, is actually a bit of a bad example of human intelligence because of its physical limitations and also because of the rules. And actually, as we know, a novel, for example, which is one of the highest things human beings have created, doesn't operate on rules anything like chess. But we see it as one of the kind of highest pinnacle achievements of what we've done.
Everything around the chess is really... There's some fascinating discussions around chess and human cognition. And you're right to say it has always been seen as this kind of pinnacle, but that's not necessarily the most helpful way of thinking about it, because, as you say, it's very rules-bound. And it's, I think the term in the literature is, you know, it's a closed yeah. system. So it has these rules that govern everything within the problem space. And that does mean it's something that you can chuck computing power at and it will help. And it is true that a lot of these AI models, where they have a lot of success, is in solving sort of closed system games like this. So not just chess, but also Go. And also, you know, I think there's a fair few computer games out there where you've got AI models that have been able to solve them. But you're right to say that is not the same as a lot of other problems, real-world problems, that humans can solve. A lot of those fuzzier, more open-ended ones, that's where, LLMs will have maybe more challenges.
And it was interesting that Alistair raised the example of the novel there and chess. Chess is one of those skills, if that's the right word, and I'd add music and mathematics to that, where one has many examples of the prodigy. There are brilliant 6 or 7 year olds who can play chess, who can compose or play music, and can also master advanced mathematics. I don't know of a 6 or 7 year old who's ever written a novel of any substance. And I wonder if there's something there, that there's something different about certain operations of the human mind, certain skills that are different fundamentally from, say, cultural endeavours such as the novel.
I think that's a tremendously fascinating point. I think that is really interesting. And even before LLMs, there were examples of AIs creating really good music that a lot of experts were unable to distinguish from music that had been created by humans. And you're right to point out as well, I'd not thought of it that way, but you're right, you know, chess, music, maths, you do get young prodigies, but can you get that with a novel? And I suppose in that sense, yeah, I think about this a lot, because LLMs are very good with text. Would they be able to create a novel? And a lot of the debate you'll see in the literature is about, oh, it's just a computing problem. At the minute, you know, maybe they can't produce something that is that long. But a lot of people just view it as an issue of length, if you like. But I think you're right. And this perhaps comes down to a difference, a nebulous difference perhaps, but between intelligence and wisdom. Is there something about perhaps writing a novel, or indeed even writing a work of history, where you might say there's an aspect there that requires wisdom and judgment? And yes, it does require a lot of knowledge, but does it also require something else, some kind of insight into human motivation and human societies, that can an LLM actually do that?
That's interesting in the form of music as well, thinking about it. If one listens, say, for example, I mean, the greatest prodigy of all, musically, Mozart, if you listen to his very early piano concertos, the first, the second, they're extremely competent forms of music, but they're not sublime in the way that the late piano concertos are, and they're certainly not what you see in his later operas, although, of course, there's a relationship between words and music there as well. But, yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, you seem to have pricked the bubble of AI here, Daisy, which is very much against this kind of hyperbolic optimism that surrounds AI with certain claims there. But I wonder if you could present a positive image of what large language models, for example, and succeeding examples of AI might achieve in education, how it could help students.
I think in their current state, I would not want to let a student loose to learn with a large language model. And that's because of the errors they make. So one of my favourite thinkers on education is an American guy called Siegfried Engelmann. And he developed this method of teaching, which is controversial and gets criticism, but has a lot of evidence in its favour, which is called direct instruction. And direct instruction involves presenting students with lots of examples of a concept and lots of non-examples and getting them to almost infer from the examples and the non-examples what the concept is. And it works very well for learning to read, for learning mathematics, for learning kind of any concept. And it's quite teacher directed. The teacher will be presenting examples and saying, this is the example, this isn't. That's maybe one of the reasons it's controversial. It's teacher directed. It doesn't involve students learning for themselves. But one of the things Engelmann says, which I think is at the heart of his philosophy, and I think at the heart of any philosophy of good education, is he says, direct instruction is all about attention to the picky detail. And this is something I think anyone who's taught will understand. And I used to be a teacher. I used to teach secondary English. That students, getting them to understand a new concept, there are so many ways in which their understanding can break down and so many ways in which they can acquire misconceptions. And you have to be so alert to the specifics of the content you are teaching and all the ways that things can go wrong. And I will give an example. As I say, I was an English teacher, and if you're just trying to teach students what a verb is, that's quite a tricky concept that you really have to think carefully about how you present it and the examples you give to students. And there's always a risk that if you give students lots of examples just by accident where the verb's always the second word in the sentence. So he ran to the shops, I walked over there, we looked around the room. They would just assume that the verb's always the second word in the sentence. Mm. So when you're constructing your examples, you have to really think carefully about making sure students, you know, aren't any of those traps that they could fall into as a result of how you have explained and exemplified something. And that picky detail is something that subject experts understand. So I understand that about verbs because I'm, you know, an English graduate and I taught English and I thought about this a lot. But that's why also I would say being able to transfer that to another subject that I don't know as well is really, really hard, because every subject will have that picky detail that really matters. And that's why I'm very reluctant to let students loose to learn with large language models at the minute, because they make these errors and they make these hallucinations. Now, there is a big debate around, are they going to always make those errors? Will they get better and better? And there are organisations out there. So there's a company out there at the minute, I think, who have developed a maths chatbot that they say they've really reduced the hallucinations and it's really working well. And again, this is a fast moving field and we have to kind of see what's out there. But my personal take would be, where the large language models are at the minute, they make too many errors to let students loose on them. And if you take my point about the picky detail being important and the potential students have misconceptions, you would not want to be letting them loose on a machine that makes this many errors. I mean, I remember when I was first using them to play around, looking at could they create maths questions, you know, setting up some questions on Pythagoras where they were confusing 13 squared and 14 squared. Now, 13 squared is 169 and 14 squared is 196. Mm. And I don't know if it was just mixing up the numbers or what was going on there. But that kind of mistake, if you're teaching a kid Pythagoras and then, you know, you've got a system that's making a mistake and confusing 13 squared and 14 squared, that's just horrible. I mean, that's just horrible if you're trying to teach something. So I don't think you can let kids loose on these as chatbots unless we fix the hallucination problem. Now, there are people out there who say we can fix it and it will be fixed in time. Let's see if it gets fixed, perhaps.
Is there not also a more fundamental kind of emotional problem, that narrowing of the didactic encounter, which is what it is. It's just saying the important thing is to learn the information and then to move on with some human guidance, whatever. I don't know what form it would take. But human beings need a picture of what they're learning for it to resonate and for it to become meaningful, part of their life, part of the exchange between our inner and outer worlds. There is no way you could learn a language without a constant mental imaging that goes on inside of what the point is of the endeavor and also of the stuff that you're learning from day to day, these situations you'd be in, the conversations you'd be having. A fundamental question like what you want from other people. And I think once you take that away and you kind of say that encounter doesn't matter so much and that it's all just utilitarian, it saps us of our sense of motivation as much as anything, and also saps the real sources of creativity. All those things that you remember most from anything I've read, it's always because it's chimed with some inner picture that is mysterious. And doing stuff through a computer does surely erode that.
But does it not also, Daisy, affect this idea that computers make things easier? And there's always, when one is learning the very basics of language, one is learning the basics of numeracy, whether it's your own language or a foreign language, but I think it's particularly explicit there, it depends upon drudgery. And part of the appeal of AI seems to be that it will take out this drudgery. But the foundational stuff that you're saying can't really be replaced when it comes to numeracy and literacy, it is by its nature full of drudgery and repetition until one is in that position where one has mastered it, or at least is articulate in it, or is numerate.
I disagree, Paul. I love the drudgery.
But you're weird and most people don't.
So I think you've both hit on a really key issue here. And as you're right to say, there is a bit of disagreement between you two there. And I think I'm not sure what side I come down on. So let me think about what I think you're saying here, which is that, Alistair, I think what you're saying is learning is something fundamentally human. Mm. And it can't just all come through a screen. So even if we fix all these problems with hallucinations, we can't all learn through a screen. We need to have that human aspect there. And I think most of my experience is, I talk a lot about school education. And I also, particularly, even though I didn't teach at primary, I think we forget that a lot of education is that education that goes on under the age of 11. Yeah. And I think the big issue you have there, where I think I've been some sympathy with you there, Alistair, is that even if you make these LLMs perfect, and even if you make them enormously fun to use, the guilty secret of all current online learning is that nobody completes it, right? Nobody gets to the end. So the thing that, and this is true not just of the ones that children use, but that adults use, yeah, they have completion rates of 2-3%. So even with all the amazing gamification and things you can do online, a lot of people who sign up for these courses don't complete them. And that's often when you're talking about really well-motivated adults. So what about when you have not very well motivated, disaffected 8-year-olds, are they going to sit in front of a screen and do their maths practice all day with no human supervision? And that also feels to me that there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley who I sometimes think have never met a real child. And I think, do you really think that these systems, as brilliant as they are going to be so compelling for children that they will use them as opposed to anything else they could be doing? And there is an aspect of the physical school which provides structure, it provides motivation, it provides a routine, and it also, I think this speaks to Alistair's point, situates that within a human context. And I'm not saying that always works well, because there's a lot of schools out there where probably things like that are not working well. But is it something you can just say we can do away with that and we can deliver everything through a screen? And I'm not so sure. I think that is a genuinely open question. And when I wrote my book about this in 2019, I said at the time, I think this is a genuinely open question. You have people who are saying, as the gamification gets better, children will be happy to sit at a screen. And after I wrote my book, COVID happened. And I tend to think that if it were possible to really teach effectively completely through a screen, COVID would have accelerated that. Yeah. Because we had a massive global, national, worldwide experiment where students could only learn through a screen for quite a long period of time. You know, in some countries, the bulk of 2 years they were out of schools. And yet, what was the biggest thing everybody wanted to open first? Everybody wanted the schools opened. Mm. Everybody wanted to get kids back in school. All the parents were saying that they're not really learning at home. Mm. And all of the learning gaps have opened up in that time. So I think there is a really important point to what Alistair says about maybe you just need to have some kind of human context for these, particularly for younger students. Mm. But then to go to Paul's point about the drudgery of it, I don't want to pretend that all schools manage learning perfectly at the minute. Clearly they don't. And clearly there are ways we should look to improve. And clearly there are a lot of things about learning, I think you're right, Paul, where there is that drudgery. And the promise of technology is that it can make things a bit more fun. And there are nice things out there. And I'm not going to be negative about them. I'm not someone who's completely anti or all technology. I work for an education technology company. There are some really nice systems out there, which I think do try and gamify things. And, you know, you can do maths problems in the context of a little game. And I think my take at the moment, where we are at the minute, would be those can be quite nice adjuncts and accessories and maybe a little homework program and something you do as a top-up. I cannot see a way in which that completely takes over.
Yeah.
I just think there has to be some kind of human structure and even a physical place. It feels very hard, particularly with children, to completely get rid of that. That's where I am at the minute, and maybe I'm totally wrong.
And the other side of the coin of drudgery is mastery and competence. You know, that seems to me another side of the story.
You have to get the practice in. I think everything we know about technology is the practice matters. I think Paul is right to point out that that practice can be quite dull for a lot of people. And if there is a way you can get the technology to help you get your repetitions in and make it a bit less boring and a bit less full of drudgery, I think that's great. But it is a big step from saying that to saying technology can do everything. We don't need a physical school. We don't need human tutors. That is a huge step. And I'm not sure we're there yet. And again, I have some doubts about whether we'll ever be there. Maybe there is something, Alistair, as you were saying, intrinsically human about learning, where we have to situate it in those human contexts. So that's where I'd be at the minute. I'm certainly open to a little bit of fun, a spoonful of sugar helping the medicine go down. But, you know, is that going to solve the whole problem?
But it remains medicine.
That's a good point.
Sometimes with a bitter taste.
I think there's a line from Aristotle where he says, I think he says the roots of education are bitter, but the fruits are sweet.
Ah, well, that is indeed true. I think I'm with Aristotle there. Well, Daisy, you seem to suggest that the classroom, the old-fashioned traditional classroom, will be with us for some time yet.
That would be my bet at the minute. It's always hard making these predictions when we're in this world, but actually COVID made me a little bit more certain on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Though you've got a lot of students who are absent and a lot of students who kind of haven't gone back to school, nobody's come up with a better method yet.
Hmm.
So you could argue COVID both ways, but it didn't lead to the huge disruption in the physical classroom that I think maybe a lot of tech boosters thought it would.
Well,
Daisy, it showed all the reasons why physical classrooms exist.
Well, Daisy, when AI is normally discussed, we have some kind of dystopian image. So your image of a perpetual traditional classroom is somewhat comforting to me. I'm sure to many of our listeners as well. And so thank you so much for talking us through this extraordinary development, or perhaps not extraordinary development. We'll see how AI unfolds over the years, but thank you for that. It's terrific analysis. And thank you, Daisy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks, Alistair. It's great to chat.
Thanks to Daisy Christodoulou. You've been listening to EI Talks on Engelsberg Ideas. EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones. And until next time, thanks for listening.